In harmony with friends and brethren, I accept this ordination. Right. So we're enjoying an atmosphere of refined harmony here on retreat. Harmony is one way of expressing the very goal of the spiritual life, because it goes beyond subject-object distinction. It's a move from vijnana to jnana, if that means anything to you. If it doesn't, ask your study group leader to explain it. Yeah, a move from vijnana to jnana. The Dharmachari should delight, and so should the Dharmacharini, delight in harmony and be ever ready and active in repairing any disharmony. So this is about the first vow was about the vertical, as it were, Kalyanamitta. This is about, as it were, horizontal Kalyanamitta. That doesn't mean that everybody's the same. There is a hierarchy, even in horizontal Kalyanamitta, but it's dynamic. Yeah, it's not fixed, and it has to be hammered out through dialogue. You can't make any sort of assumptions about, when you're talking to an order member, for instance, that he's the slightest bit sussed, knows anything about the Dharma. You've just got to engage and see what you get. And likewise, if you're at a class and you engage with what looks like a completely new beginner, you could get a big shock. I certainly did this in my very early days. Sometimes you talk to people and they look like they're off the streets and they don't know a thing. And actually they're quite sussed. And they may in fact know more about the Dharma and practice than you do. So you have to engage and work that out. There's a very nice little story in the Pali Canon. I don't know the reference for this. But there's a young monk and he's in this lodging. That's what they used to do. And the Buddha turns up, and the Buddha goes to the owner of the lodging and says, "Can I stay here?" And the owner says, "Well, you better go and see this other monk who's already here and talk to him, you know, and if he's happy with it, then fine." So the Buddha goes and sits down with this young monk and they start talking. And this young monk is actually a disciple of the Buddha, but he's never met the Buddha before. So they just start talking. They just start talking away. And slowly, slowly, it dawns on the young monk that this guy is actually quite sussed. And eventually it dawns on him, this is my teacher. This is the Buddha. But the Buddha doesn't sort of swan in and, you know, I am the Buddha and all that sort of stuff. They hammer it out. They hammer out who's the superior, if you like, who's higher in the hierarchy. So that's what it should be like. Most of the time with your fellow mitras, younger order members, even older order members, sometimes you have to sort of drop your assumptions about, as it were, rank and engage. Engagement is the thing. So what is harmony? I mean, there are all sorts of dictionary definitions in all sorts of dictionaries, but I won't go into that too much. Johnson, for instance, says it's the just adaptation of one part to another. Harmonize means to agree, to correspond, to adjust, to fit proportions. Concord is another word for harmony. And concord means sort of agreement, peace, union. When you start delving into these words, it does get quite interesting. What else have I got here? Yeah, apparently the derivation of concord, I think it's concord, is from the Greek, and it means a joint fitting. So, you know, when you do carpentry, you want the joint to really fit, yeah? So that's what we're looking for with other people. We're looking to harmonize, to be compatible. Not the same, but compatible. So there's quite a lot in that, compatibility. Sort of acknowledges difference, if you like. Harmony, fitting together of parts so as to form a connected whole. Agreement in relation. Anything else there? Congruous. I like this word, congruous. Or congruent, if you've ever come across that. So things aren't the same, but they can be congruent. Yeah, like congruent triangles, if you remember your mathematics. The state of being of the same heart or mind. A combination of sounds satisfying to the ear. From the Latin, of the same heart, I think. That's harmony. So harmony has a great deal to do with the whole business of psychological and emotional and spiritual integration and maturity. Growing up, which I talked about this morning, yeah? Om, grow up, hum. Which is much easier said than done. I rather like this expression. It was certainly that I met a few in the old days, and I try not to be one myself, but they say there's no fool like an old fool. So don't be an old fool at whatever age you are, yeah? Don't be an old fool. Keep open and vital. And this is much easier said than done. Avoid disharmony, particularly with people in the movement, friends, inverted commas, whether they're your friends or not. I'll say more about this later. Mitras, dharmacharis and dharmacharinis, yeah? Look for harmony, avoid disharmony. I don't know if you've ever come across Banti's two sets of 15 points for older members, new and old and new. They're well worth looking at because they'll give you a good idea about the sorts of things that Banti thinks are important for older members, young and old, new and old, as it were. Number 8 of the second set, Banti says, discuss, don't argue. Discuss, don't argue. To argue is wanting to win, to beat the other person at all costs, whereas discussion is a mutual exploration to find the truth. It's cooperation, to at least try to understand the truth of the issue in question. There should be no competitiveness in the negative sense within the spiritual community. I think there is a place for positive competitiveness, but you might like to discuss that in your groups. It's very easy for discussion to become argument, especially if the matter under discussion provokes strong feelings in both the partners, both the parties concerned. Which brings us back to what I mentioned this morning. If you find yourself getting cranked and angry in discussion with somebody else, rejoice. Yeah? Again, rejoice. One of your little props for the ego is being rattled. Yeah, so it's got nothing to do with the other person. What's going on for you? Yeah, your ego is being threatened. Why is that? It's just another human being with a different point of view. Why should you feel so threatened? Why should you get cranked up? Yeah, it's a very interesting sort of area. I love all that sort of stuff. Yeah, there's always the danger of discussion becoming argument as long as ego is present. And for most of us, that's going to be a very long time indeed. It's very easy to slide into argument. However, you're probably having a reaction because one of your cherished wrong views upon which you build your personal security is being poked and threatened. In psychotherapeutic circles, they used to say, when I was bashing about in them, one is never upset for the reason one thinks one is. Yeah? So if you find yourself getting cranked with somebody, you'll come up with a rationalisation immediately. That's not it. Yeah? That's not the reason why you're getting cranked. You'll find all sorts of, we do this almost automatically. We find a nice rationalisation for why we're right and they're wrong. But it's not the reason. Yeah, it's not the reason at all. It's not... we're not upset for the reason we think we are. So we have to be careful. You will have arguments. You will have reactions. So learn how to deal with them. Watch and learn from others. Yeah, if you see two people falling out, just sort of, without attracting too much attention, sort of go over and listen and just watch how they deal with it. And especially if one of them's quite skillful and can sort of deal with it. Because that's what we've all got to learn to do. We've got to learn to deal with discord, really. So you might like to talk about that in your groups. How do you get on with discord? You know, yourself with other people. How do you get on when you see two other people in discord having an argument? Banti says that having two order members out of communication and in conflict is one of the most painful things he has to endure. He doesn't like it at all. It's painful for him to see two order members at loggerheads, so to speak. So try to be honest about what's happening when you do get angry, react or start arguing, so that at least if you can do that, you'll preserve your personal integrity. Yeah, if you fly completely off the handle, you've probably lost your personal integrity. So preserving personal integrity usually means confessing that you're reacting and you're angry. That's all you have to do. Just be open and honest about what's going on for you. And remember, if you're angry or reacting, you're not thinking straight. Yeah, you're probably in a negative mental state. Negative mental states are not a condition where you can think straight. Yeah, you'll get the wrong end of the stick as long as you're in a negative mental state. Don't do any thinking on the basis of negative mental states. It's a complete waste of time. At all times, try to move towards people rather than against them or away from them. I've seen this a number of times, that you get this tragic scenario where two people fall out. One of them is you get different sorts of attitudes to this. You get the sort of, come here, you know, somebody will pull you in when they're angry with you. And other people will, get off, back off, I want space. So if those two fall out with each other, you know, this person wants to engage, this person wants to get away, so you end up with a sort of, you know, a sort of chase going on, and it's really painful to watch. Neither of them gets what they want, they both get very frustrated and more angry. It's, as I say, it's tragic to watch. What we need to do, I suppose, is identify ourselves to ourselves. We need to change ourselves into someone who moves towards other people, someone who is interested in other people. It's an interesting idea, that, isn't it? How do you get interested in other people? If you're not interested in them, you won't listen to them. And if you don't listen to them, again, communication is not going to take place. How do you get interested in a very wide variety of other people? I think that interest, like other faculties, I don't know if that's the right word, other faculties like meta and friendship, interest is a decision. Yeah, it's a decision. It's got nothing to do with the other person. I don't think meta's got anything to do with the other person, in a manner of speaking, nor is friendship. If you make a decision to be metaful, friendly or interested, doesn't matter what the other person does. You can just decide that that's what you're going to do. I don't think we take that. That's thinking straight, yeah? That's thinking positively. That's what we need to do. We need to engage. And we just have to decide to engage. Many years ago, April 1999, there was a reporting in from Mahamati, quoting Subhuti. Subhuti gave this talk in India about the six weeds living in the wilderness of the human heart. I don't know if anybody ever came across this. Yeah? No? Doesn't look like it. The six weeds living in the wilderness of the human heart are suspicion, rumour, taking sides, jealousy, breaking off communication, and complaining. Yeah? Suspicion, rumour, taking sides when two other people fall out, jealousy, breaking off communication, and complaining. So what Subhuti said in this little piece was, you know, if you find these weeds, any of these six weeds in your garden, pull them up. Get rid of these weeds and plant instead confession, forgiveness, rejoicing in merits and gratitude. Confession, forgiveness, rejoicing in merits and gratitude. And he said that these were the four fundamental emotions for a spiritual community. Then you'll have a beautiful garden that leads to the transcendental. Do all the digging and weeding in the garden of your own heart. Yeah, you don't do it in other people's. Yeah, that's their business. It's not your business. Unless you've actually entered into some sort of contract with them. You know, like if a junior Kalyana Mitra, for instance, asks you to intervene and tell you when you think he's going wrong, that's a different matter. But you don't just blunder into other people's gardens and start ripping up what you think are the weeds. Yeah, don't do that, or you'll end up in disharmony, I'm afraid. And especially be careful with this business with juniors or the less experienced friends and mitras. That's that little piece. Now. There's, I think this is the... can't remember the source for this. Again, it's Pali Canon. Seven conditions for the long life of the order. There's an interesting backstory to this. I think it's King Pasenadi. He wants to do away. He wants to invade the adjoining sort of state. So he sends one of his ministers to go and see the Buddha, and he says, "Go and ask the Buddha how I do this." You know. And you'd think the Buddha wouldn't sort of have anything to do with that. And in a way, he doesn't. What he does is he tells this minister, well, there are seven things that will sort of engender the long life of this state that your king wants to invade. Yeah. And as long as they're doing that, you know, invading is a waste of time. So he tells the minister these seven. And the minister goes away. And then the Buddha calls Ananda over and he says, right, listen to these. These are the seven conditions for the long life of the order as well. Just to finish off the little backstory, apparently what happens is that they maintain all these seven in this state that the king wants to invade. So what he has to do is he has to send in spies who upset things. They get in the way of these seven sort of procedures being done, and then the state crumbles and he invades, and I think he conquers them. But anyway, it's interesting that I find that very interesting. The seven are, first of all, meeting in large numbers, and that is face to face. You might just get away with Skype. I've got a number of friends who do Skyping, and it does seem to be reasonably successful. I've always found it dreadful myself, but I haven't done very much of it. Face to face. So this is all the gatherings that you might go to. Yeah. So going for refuge groups. What else are there? Kula gatherings, yeah. When you're ordained, there are chapters, order weekends, conventions, kula gatherings where you can meet with order members as well. And you do it for others. You don't do it for yourself. Arlok is very strong on all this. You just put yourself in. You can't have an order life on your own terms. So if you don't like big gatherings, get over it, yeah? You're going to have to engage in big gatherings. Now, you may be a delicate introvert. There are ways of doing big gatherings. I'm a little bit of an introvert myself, believe it or not. There are ways of doing this. I might as well tell you about that now, I think. Yeah. This is, again, one of Arloka's practices. What he says to do, we were on a convention one time, and we had a little walk, and then he said, "Let's just sit down and look at all the members." So we sat on this bench and we watched order members going past. Oh, look, this old so-and-so. God, I haven't seen her for ages, you know, kind of, all this sort of thing. And sometimes people would come up, you know, friends of mine or friends of his, and they say, oh, nice to see you. Can we have a chat? And I would say, no, we're not talking. We're looking at order members. We're just observing them, seeing them and enjoying them. So he makes a practice of that, and you'll see him. Well, you certainly used to see him. I mean, he's a bit ill these days, so he doesn't get on many of those things. But that was one of his favourite practices, and I used to do it with him. He sort of taught me how to do it. So, this is face-to-face, isn't it? Yeah. Second condition, you meet in harmony. You conduct your business or interactions in harmony, and you part in harmony. Yeah, that's the second condition for the long life of the order. I mean, for order, you know, movement, if you like. So I think what has to happen here, or one of the things that we can sort of employ here, is going beyond likes and dislikes. I've always been quite interested in likes and dislikes. I've tried to write a talk about it once, but I didn't get very far. I've got some rough notes. Let's just see what I've got on likes and dislikes. Why is it that we have certain likes and dislikes? They are all conditioned things produced by previous causes and networks of causes. They all come from past experience and past actions. None of them are absolute. You cannot say it is valid to like X or invalid to dislike Y. Yeah, you can't do that. It's not appropriate. It doesn't fit with likes and dislikes, which are basically habits reinforced continually by the internal monologue and by speech with other people all the time. In a way, that's how we identify ourselves. I don't like oranges with my supper. Some people really like to have an orange after they've eaten. I don't like that. So very often we'll spend a lot of time telling other people what we like and what we don't like. It sort of fills us out as a person. Maybe if you use your imagination, you can see that you do that. And you can certainly see other people do it. You know, when something happens, I don't like that. Oh, I rather like it. Or a piece of music. I don't like that piece of music. Oh, I like it. You know, isn't that interesting? You know, and it's all habits being reinforced. They're ruts, yeah? Our identity is made up largely, but not entirely, by a vast catalogue of likes and dislikes. It's as if we give everything a little electrical charge, stick a positive or negative charge on everything, so that we are drawn to the positive and repelled by the negative. Yeah, there are things that we don't like and we push them away. I mean, it's basically craving and aversion, yeah, but in a very sort of subtle kind of way. And we take this on, we reinforce our personality with this. Yeah, so try and think about that, see if you can sort of get over it a bit, if you can. This is how we set up our identity, how we tell the story of the kind of person that we are. Someone who likes this doesn't like that. Da-da-da-da-da, I think I've already told you that. Different people have different likes and dislikes, which can seem really weird to us. You know, how can anybody like that? You know, and they'll look at you and think, how can you like that? It just seems strange to us that other people don't like the things that we like, and they like the things we don't like. Yeah, so really try and be aware of those differences between different people. And we tend to think that these likes and dislikes are part of us, but of course they're not part of us. Another person isn't part of us. An example that Ratnaprabha used in a talk once was that if you sneeze over yourself and it goes everywhere, it's not such a big deal. You just sort of clear it up, don't you? But if somebody else sneezes on you, it's like, you know, somebody else's body fluid, get rid of it. Horrible, yeah? We have a real sort of reaction to it, an aversion to somebody else's bodily fluids. But it just, I mean, it's just fluids. It just happens to be a different body. Or another example is, if I'm picking my nose, I can get quite interested in the results, yeah, what I actually dig out. But if somebody else is picking their nose, it's like, oh, gross, you know, I don't want to. And they're looking at it as well. They might even be eating it, yeah? It's like, oh, no. We don't like that, yeah? Just because it's somebody else's. If we can see the relativity of our own likes and dislikes, then we can sit a bit looser to them. All this can sound rather negative, as if Vedana is the enemy and that it's dreadful and that one should ignore one's likes and dislikes. No, we shouldn't do that. We should pay attention to them, watch them, and try and get behind them. Why are the way they are? Why are they the way they are? Yeah. All right. We're going through the seven conditions, aren't we? Three, established training principles. So this means continuity. Continuity of practice, if you like, the training principles. There is this saying, non-repetition, I think it's in the Dhammapada even, non-repetition is the cancer of the tradition. Yeah, we need to be doing things again and again and again. It's the only way we learn, really. Same old stuff every day. Same old metta bhavana, same old study texts, same old community members, Kalyana Mitras, same old sevenfold puja. But hopefully it's all going a bit deeper every time we do it. Bored. Yeah, we might become bored with some of the practices we do. That's good. It means you come to the limits of your understanding. So go deeper, yeah? I rather like to sort of look for boredom. I mean, these days when I try and find it, I can't find it anymore. When I was younger, I used to find it all the time. But it's a very elusive beast these days. Go deeper. You've come to the end of... sometimes people say, oh, I've come to the end of metta bhavana. I can't do that anymore. That's interesting, isn't it? You've come to the end. You've fully developed a limitless, an immeasurable. I don't believe that. That's not what it says in the Pali Canon. No, you've come to the end of yourself. And maybe that's a good thing. So do more. Do more of the same. Four... respect, revere, venerate the elders. And I talked about this morning, yeah? Even the Buddha wanted this, yeah? He wanted something to venerate and to look up to. Which is interesting because it suggests that enlightenment isn't the end, it's just the horizon. Yeah? If the Buddha's looking for something further, then we should be looking beyond enlightenment as well. And we certainly shouldn't imagine that we're going to stop when we get to enlightenment. That's ridiculous. I suppose a question that lies behind this, are we open to the higher? Are we open to other people who might be more developed than us? You know, have something to tell us? And when we engage in our dialogue with them, they come out being more integrated and all the rest of it. Are we open to that? Can we put up with it? Some people don't like that. If you're into winning, you probably won't like that. Five, don't fall under the power of craving. It's a very simple one, really. That's what gives rise to repeated becoming, to conditioned existence. It's the reactive mind, and ideally we don't want anything to do with it. Read Banti's Mind Reactive and Creative if you've never come across that. It's a lovely little book. It's one of the first things I read a long time ago. But it's very succinct and clear. Six, I forget how this is worded, but it's about the forest depths. Yeah, I suppose immediately this is sort of solitary retreats. For the Sangha to survive, it needs full-timers. And this doesn't mean just good meditators. Full-timers provide the context for others to dip in to regular retreats, yeah? I mean, for instance, you know, the fact that there's a community here and a team, an ordination team, continually doing the same stuff means that you can come and join in with that. If we weren't here, you'd be left to your own devices, and we'd all be the worse off for that. I'd certainly be worse off for that. I need to be permanently at the coalface, or I fall asleep. Forest steps. Seven, I've shortened this to mindfulness with attitude. So it's remembering, that is sati, yeah, remembering to practice metta for all. In the spiritual life, you probably noticed this already, you end up with people you wouldn't ever go near in the outside world. Yeah, when you were working, perhaps, before you came along to the movement, you know, you'd think, oh God, look at that. So you just find ways of avoiding them. You can't do that in the spiritual community. Yeah, you can't ask them to leave. You can't leave yourself. You must transform yourself. Yeah, you've got to find out, well, what's interesting about this person? Why are they there? I don't like them. Why don't I like them? What's that? Is that likes and dislikes again? Do they remind me of somebody that I don't like? What are they doing that upsets me? Is my ego involved in this? Yeah, all sorts of interesting questions come up like that. And I keep using this expression, sort of ego. I mean, the sort of traditional way of describing this is dharmakata, yeah? Investigation of your own mental states. Why your mental states do the things that they do. But, you know, ego is something that we can sort of relate to perhaps a bit more directly. The Sangha is not a closed system. We have to invite others in, all of them. Yeah, we've got to adapt and let other people in. So that means being able to communicate with other people. Let me just see whether I'm on that bit. So communication. Benti's got some interesting things to say about communication in the meaning of conversion in Buddhism. I think it's also in the history of my going for refuge in a shortened form. So I'll read you a little bit of this, yeah? I'll read you a sort of longer bit because it all fits in with some of what I said this morning as well. Before you can effectively get, this is page 26 for the studious. Before you can effectively go for refuge to the Sangha, you and all the people who form that Sangha need to have a common spiritual teacher or ideal and a common spiritual teaching or principle. We talked a bit about this morning. It's this which makes it possible for people to come together into the spiritual community or Sangha. The fact that they go for refuge to the Buddha and the Dharma naturally draws people together. But is this all? What do we mean by together? It does not just mean physical proximity. Coming together to sit in a kind of congregation is not enough to form a Sangha. We may all quite sincerely take the Buddha for our spiritual teacher, and we may all be sincerely trying to practice, follow, and realize the Dharma. We may all agree on doctrinal questions and even have the same meditation experiences. But these things do not in themselves mean that we constitute a Sangha. Going for refuge to the Sangha is rather more subtle than that. It's essentially a matter of communication. When there is communication among those who go for refuge to the Buddha and the Dharma, then there is going for refuge to the Sangha. The communication which characterizes the Sangha is not merely an exchange of ideas or information. If I say to somebody, last week I was in Norwich, they will no doubt understand that statement perfectly. A successful exchange of ideas will have taken place, but there is not necessarily been any communication. If we find our contacts with others, even our friendships, frustrating and disappointing, if we find the exchanges we have with people at work or at parties a bit meaningless, It is because we are not using them as a medium for communication. So what is communication? This is the meat of it. It isn't very easy to say. For the purposes of exploring the Sangha refuge, a working definition might be a vital mutual responsiveness on the basis of a common ideal and a common principle. A vital mutual responsiveness on the basis of a common ideal and a common principle. This is communication in the context of going for refuge. A shared exploration of the spiritual world between people who are in a relationship of complete honesty and harmony. The communication is the exploration, and the exploration is the communication. In this way, spiritual progress takes place. I love that. While we just drip this in, you might like to talk about this in your group. Have you anybody not come across communication exercises? You sure? Anybody done them? Yeah, things aren't as bad as I thought they might be. Probably about 20 years ago, I gave a talk in Manchester, and I said, okay, what about communication exercises? And everybody sort of went, eh? And they all looked at the alderman, and I looked at the alderman, and he went, They didn't do communication exercises. Communication exercises are a really sort of challenging way of exploring just how upfront and practical your metta-bhavana, mindfulness of breathing is, whether you can engage, whether you're sort of interested, all the things I've been talking about, they come to the fore. If you haven't got them, it'll stick out quite quickly when you do communication exercises. I think they're magnificent, and we don't do them half as often as we ought to. All right, let's see if I can find my place again. I talked about, go to all gatherings as much as you can. Bhante used to say that people should be prepared to travel hundreds of miles to hear a live Dharma talk. Hundreds of miles to hear a live Dharma talk. I don't think that happens very much anymore. Go to your local festival days. So what happens with these things is that we don't often feel like it. We don't feel like going, do we? We may not like big gatherings. I mentioned this earlier. We've got to learn how to do them, and we learn to do them by going on them with somebody who can do them, yeah? And, letting them sort of letting them take us under their wing. Being in the order and being at big gatherings is a practice, just as much as meditation and all the rest of it, yeah? It can be learned. It can be learned. So go to all these events, whether you feel like it or not. A favourite saying of mine, of Aloka's, is that, I've always loved this. He said, feelings are like ferrets. It's really interesting to watch them running around. But you wouldn't want to base your life activities on their movements. They're just ferrets running around. Well, that's what your feelings are like, yeah? So don't be swayed by them. They are not all pervasive. They are not in charge. Since when has feeling been a good indicator of nearness to reality? Sometimes we fall in love and we feel like this person, and it's madness, yeah? It's complete madness. Now this brings me to another little list. Many, many years ago, I don't think he'd mind me quoting this because he's quoted it himself in talks. Padmavajra wrote to Bhante because he was suffering from, disturbing emotions, yeah? So he wrote to Bhante and said, how do I deal with disturbing emotions? And Bhante said, well, there's a little list of things that will sustain you until insight arises. Meditation, puja, spiritual friendship, dharma study, and selfless service. Selfless service. I mean, the other four we've sort of heard of, but selfless service. These are your only protection, Banti said, against disturbing emotions. They'll serve you as the basis for the attainment of transcendental insight. I rather like that. So, as I said before, acknowledge that you will... How long can I go on for?
Just keep going.
All right, okay. You might want to throw the towel in at some point. So I repeat, you will experience disharmony with others. This is almost inevitable. And especially, I think, within the order. Once people have got a case around their neck, their views tend to sort of fix a bit. Yeah. There's a really nice little saying I like. I think it comes from the Tibetan tradition. I don't have to have an opinion. And you meet some people sometimes, and they've got an opinion about absolutely everything. Yeah, you don't have to have an opinion. You can just listen and take it in and let it pass over you. So expect to be in disharmony and learn how to deal with it. And I've talked about that a bit already, haven't I? Check out these 15 points, these two sets of 15 points. I mean, I think they're little booklets in the, on sale in the foyer. Yeah, they're really worth looking at, and I won't go through them. Although I could. I mentioned this morning, didn't I, Trungpa Rinpoche, and the book that I referred to, Om Grow Up Hung, I think is cutting through spiritual materialism. And the other thing that he says in there that I think is of note is that it's essential for spiritual progress that we get an objective reference outside of ourselves about what we're like. We really need to know what we're like. Not what we think we're like or we'd like to be like, but what we're actually like, yeah? And, you know, if you've got a good spiritual friend, you can ask them. But I think you can be a bit more sort of adventurous than that. And, you know, if you meet somebody and you get on reasonably well, just say to them, how do you find my communication? You know, is it fairly smooth and easy, or anything I do that's a bit, you know, a bit jangly? Just take a risk and see what you get. That sort of feedback is vital. And it's gold dust, yeah? If you can get somebody to tell you what they think you're like, doesn't mean they're right necessarily. You have to sort of shop around, get a few versions. But if the same thing crops up in three or four people's versions of what you're like, you're onto something, yeah? Three or four people are probably not wrong. They're probably right. And listen to it and see if you can change it, yeah? What are our quirks in communications? Sometimes our friends won't tell us. They'll just ignore it. Or sometimes they find it sort of endearing. So they'll sort of laugh and put up with your funny little ways and find it, yeah, quite sort of amusing. But you need to know that stuff. It's vital, certainly for order members, that they learn what they are like in a more objective way. They need to know how they communicate. And it's good. It's a good opportunity here. We're all a bit sort of softened up. You know, take a risk. Ask somebody when you're, you know, if you've had a few conversations with somebody at the dinner table, just say to them, so what do you think of my communication? Is it difficult or easy or, you know, smooth, rough? What do you reckon? And just see what they say. It's quite a sort of useful bit of information. Again, remember this, don't dig in other people's hearts unless you've been invited in, yeah? I think there needs to be much more of this sort of investigation of our own character going on throughout the movement. This is what should happen in a good Going for Refuge group or a good chapter, yeah? These sorts of things should be coming up quite sort of regularly and obviously. So listen to what others tell you about their impressions of you and rejoice that they care enough to be honest with you and are courageous enough to take the risk of being honest. It's vital that we listen to others in this way, especially, as I say, if enough others share the same observations. Another sort of interesting practice that you might try, I mean, this won't be easy for some of you, I know, but, well, I mean, to some extent you're doing it here probably. Try sharing a room with somebody. I know on a retreat it's fairly easy, isn't it? It's just a week and you can put up with their little foibles and, you know, you can sort of grit your tooth until the end and then you're free kind of thing. But try saying to them by the end, oh, why don't we both go on the next retreat and we'll share a room again? And they might go, no, kind of thing. But it's worth a try, you know. Keep trying to share with people. It's interesting to share a room with somebody for a longer period, maybe like several years. You really learn a lot about yourselves. I found this when I first moved here. I was in a caravan out in the back where the community part was. We didn't have buildings there. We just had caravans. And I noticed after a while that when I went into my caravan and closed the door on my own, my mental state sort of became invisible. They just sort of disappeared. But when I started sharing a room with Padmavajra, it's like I was aware of my reactions and, you know, my sort of disgruntlements and likes and dislikes all the time. And we shared the same room for several years. So it was a very sort of important lesson. I even learnt to not be woken up by snores. You know, this went on for a few years. I thought, God, I can't sleep through this. And then one day I just thought, well, you know, it's just a noise, relax. And then I was out. And after that, it didn't bother me. So, yeah, share a room with somebody. Get used to positive compromise. There was a newspaper article in the UK. This is quite a while ago, actually. I think it's still the case, though. This would have been 1903. It's quite a long time ago. Things haven't got any better. They've got worse. But what they said was that current affluence means that most children have their own rooms at a very young age. And this is seen as a possible contribution to the rise in delinquency and vandalism. Because children don't get socialised. They've got their own little world. Usually they're on a computer, aren't they, as well? They've got a computer in their room and a telly. They don't need other people. They can just do everything they like. But if you get, you know, like thousands and thousands of young people with that sort of attitude, what sort of society are you going to have? And I know, like, for instance, in Japan, I don't know how they're getting on with it now, but several years ago, this became a big problem because they had young people, like, in their early to mid-teens, who wouldn't leave their rooms. They wouldn't even leave their room. Everything they needed was in there. All they needed was for mum, and Japanese mums would do this. Mum just brings them the food and they put out the empty plates and carry on with their nice little insular life on their own. Very, very dangerous. Terrible thing to happen. This didn't used to happen over here. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I'm quite old now, but I slept in the same bed as my younger brother till I was 16. We didn't have much money, working class people. That's what you did. I think my mum said she shared a bed with two other sisters until she was well into her teens. That's what you did. People didn't have money for lots of beds and single rooms and stuff. I think, as I say, it does socialise you. You get used to being around other people and less sort of, ego identified, I suppose. Told you about that. There are, unfortunately, some mitras, friends, order members with communication difficulties. And this is a generalisation. It's not always the case, but the older one gets with these sorts of difficulties, unexamined and unchallenging, the more deep-rooted and intractable they become. We set in our ways as we age if we're not very, very careful. So try and set flexibility and compromise and the desire to harmonise into your ways, especially if you're still young. Yeah, Turn your settings to that, yeah? If you get feedback from others that there's something about your communication that's complicating your relationships with others, get help. Talk to your, you know, your Kalyana Mitras. Even seek professional advice if necessary. Go and see Attila at the LBC, yeah? Or find a counsellor and investigate it. Go on a short counselling course, yeah? If nothing else, you'll learn how to listen. I know I did one years and years ago, and it's astounding when they do this listening exercise. Somebody talks to you for about 5 minutes about their life, and you just listen. Then you have to tell them what they've said, and when the clock stops, it's like, God, I haven't remembered anything. You know, I just haven't been listening. I've been looking, but you know, the mind's been elsewhere. So we need to be able to listen. So, and you can train in these things, even outside of the movement. I need to watch it now, I'm sort of running out of time. What else do I need to tell you that's really important? Done that. There's another list. Again, I'm not quite sure where you find this, called the four Sangraha Vastus, which are they're the means by which a bodhisattva gathers a sangha. And we can all employ these. Yeah, there's only four of them. We're generous. We practice kindly speech. We practice beneficial activity. And we practice exemplification. Exemplification means that we do what we say we're going to do. And again, that's not easy to begin with. It needs a bit of maturity and integration. But we can learn to practice those four. I don't know if you've been to public ordinations. I mean, we have quite a number of public ordinations here at Padmaloka. It's not the same in Gukyaloka because they're sort of still semi-closed. But at a public ordination where you get members of the public and people's families come in, you get this incredible atmosphere of joyous harmony in the room. You know, the new ordinee is happy because he's got his kesar and he's, you know, he feels like he's entering and starting a new life. Other order members are really happy because there's somebody else to put their shoulder to the wheel along with them. This harmony that you get on those events is very, very attractive. And outside of something like a public ordination, it's very, very rare. So, as I said, in a way, this harmony is the goal of the spiritual life. It's seeing the interpenetration of all things, all people, overcoming subject-object duality. The order is not a legal entity. It's not a legal entity. It doesn't exist outside of being a network of friendships. Yeah, so you can't sue the order because it doesn't exist. Yeah? It's just connections between people. That's all there is. So we need to make those connections as strong as we possibly can. It's the web of friendship that I talked about this morning, the sort of the network. All differences can be transcended. Age, background, nationality, race, sexual proclivity, lifestyle. Banti says that any human is capable of communication with any other human being. And I'll read you this bit and maybe I'll finish with that actually. It's from a little piece. It's in the Puja Readings book actually, Why I Am a Buddhist. But it's just a short paragraph of that. I believe that humanity is basically one. I believe that it is possible for any human being to communicate with any other human being, to feel for any other human being. This is what I truly and deeply believe. This belief is part of my own experience. It's part of my own life. It's part of me. I cannot live without this belief, and I would rather die than give it up. To me, to live means to practice this belief. That did.